Well, the time has come to introduce our speaker. And to do so, we have Mike Armstrong, a member since 2004, I believe. And Mike himself has been a speaker in front of this club. So here's Mike.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Last year, I received a call from the Forum Club, and they said, say, you're associated with Johns Hopkins Medicine, which I am. Would Hopkins Medicine be interested in speaking at the Forum Club? Now, that was a leading and easy question to get, because there's one thing that I quickly figured out that almost everybody in this room is: a patient. And being a patient is really one of the most personal experiences that we undertake. Being a patient is about us. And being a patient is often about what we don't know, and sometimes about life itself. And so, responding to the Forum Club that Hopkins Medicine would love to talk to the Forum Club about patient safety, and the very best person to deliver that message, and I believe everybody in the newsletter saw his bio, is Dr. Peter Pronovost. And he's been a leader, a world leader, in research, discovery, and delivery of safer medicine for patients everywhere. I'd just like to share a couple of personal notes, if I may, in introducing Peter. First, he chose patient safety as a career path after watching his dad die as a result of a medical error. He has recorded that story along with the story of his journey from being a young researcher to an international leader in patient safety in his new book, Safe Patient, Smart Medicine, that comes out today, coincidentally. How's that for timing? Second, using his system of checklist, culture, change, and measurement, he virtually eliminated central line bloodstream infections in the state of Michigan. As a result, he now has federal support to take his approach to every state in our country. And the World Health Organization support to take it to the rest of the world. He's also a dedicated dad with a 12-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter who wraps him around her finger quite regularly, we just heard. He's also a dedicated runner. And if you were out on the beach this morning at 6 a.m., you would have seen Peter and Dr. Alan Weiss, the CEO of Naples Community Hospital, running up a storm. And after they ran up a storm, Peter went over at 8 o'clock and addressed Naples Community Hospital staff, nurses, and doctors, and after an hour and a half had to pull them away from a circle of what I hope are people who are going to be that much more safer having interacted with Dr. Pronovost. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Peter Pronovost.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, and it's a truly extraordinary honor for me to be here and present to you today. You know, when I arrived here at the reception, Eula and several others were commenting about how young I look. You know, and I'll tell you, about, oh, I don't know, 8 months ago, I was giving a talk down in Dallas, and I'd been on call the night before, and so I probably looked a little bit harried and had a shadow, and I was a bit late for the talk, so I'm getting off the plane, and they had a driver waiting for me with the sign Dr. Pronovost, and so I'm running off the airplane. I said, hey, come on, buddy, let's go. I'm late for my talk, and he says, oh, no, 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 Sonny, I'm waiting for a famous doctor from Johns Hopkins. I said, I don't know about the famous part, but that's me. You know, the advances in biomedical sciences are nothing short of breathtaking. Our life expectancy since 1960 has gone up from 65 to 72. AIDS is now a chronic disease. Most heart failure is survivable, even with implantable artificial hearts. Virtually all childhood cancers are curable. The results are truly breathtaking. And yet, that same health system that leads to these amazing discoveries leaves sponges in patients. The Institute of Medicine told us that it kills 100,000 people a year. Now, the true estimate of preventable deaths, to be honest, we don't really know. But let me frame it for you how big of a problem this is. There's probably up to 100,000 people die from what we might call mistakes of commission. We do something either the wrong way or that we shouldn't do. There's another 100,000 people that die from infections that we give you in the hospital. 100,000 people who die from that. There's probably somewhere between 50 to 100,000 people who die from diagnostic errors. Diagnostic errors like my father, unfortunately, died from. But to be honest, we don't really have a good estimate how big that problem is because we don't have a good way of measuring those errors. But we do know when we looked at several autopsy studies, they suggest that somewhere around 30% of the time, what you were being treated for was not what the autopsy showed. Right? Think about how horrible that is. And your chance of receiving the right medical treatments, that is, if there's evidence to say, if I have this disease, I should get this drug, the study suggests that it's a coin toss. That in across the U.S., whether you would get the right medicine, you might as well flip a coin and do it. And I think that's why many of us have so much anxiety when either you or your loved ones are hospitalized. And this idea, I suspect most of you have in some way have your own story. Now, medicine does amazing things, and we're really blessed to have it. But it also has a lot of shortcomings that we need to start to talk about. Because far too often, your comments are often not welcome to a doctor. Even though it's your body, we are often feel like we're hushed, and if we second guess, we're not welcomed. Or you're harmed rather than helped from healthcare, and we need to start to do things a different way. Now, most of you, I'm sure, have been following this health reform debate, and it's a debate that's long overdue. Our healthcare is too costly. We spend about $8,000 per capita, or $2.7 trillion on healthcare. It's far too limited in its access. We have 47 million people who don't have insurance, and it far often harms rather than helps people. And in towns like mine, where I live, many mothers in Baltimore have to choose between paying the rent or bringing their kid to the clinic. Many elderly have to choose between putting food on the table and buying their medicines. And that shouldn't be in a system as wealthy as ours. Now, I want you to imagine that there's a disease that kills 2.5 million people over the last quarter century, 100,000 a year. And some researchers at Johns Hopkins, tinkering around in their work, found a cure to virtually eliminate these. They then spread that cure to the state of Michigan and virtually eliminated that disease there. If that therapy was a drug or a device, you could be rest assured within months it would be throughout the world. Right? It would be produced by the private sector, its cost would come down, its quality would go up, and we would eliminate this disease. But the disease is real. It's these infections that we give you when you go to the hospital. And the cure was equally real. But it wasn't a drug. It wasn't a device. It was a relatively simple safety program. A program that involved creating a checklist, something as simple as a checklist to ensure that doctors do what they're supposed to. It was a program that empowered nurses to speak up and ensure that doctors used the checklist, something heretical in most of medicine, and a program that held clinicians accountable for measuring their rates of these infections. You see, when you go into most hospitals in this country, Even though those 100,000 deaths from infections are largely preventable, you have no idea what your risk is. We don't share that data. Some hospitals don't even measure it. There's a few states that have mandated that it's publicly reported, but very few. And even amongst those, we just looked at their data, and the data has, it's somewhere between 80 to 60% of the data is missing. So it's really noisy and something you would never tolerate in your financial performance data, and yet we somehow seem to tolerate in our clinical data. So I want to share with you how we tackled that one problem of these healthcare-acquired infections, and specifically one type of them, infections that occur from catheters that we often place into people's neck. They occur in people who have big operations, who might go to intensive care units, who have dialysis, who get chemotherapy. They're used quite often. About half of ICU patients have them. And that one disease kills up to 60,000 people a year. To put it in perspective, breast cancer probably kills around 34,000 a year. AIDS in this country is somewhere around 12,000 a year. So it's an enormous public health problem. And the secret, perhaps the dirty little secret, is that they're all needless. They are entirely preventable. So I set out to try to do that in my little corner of the world, Johns Hopkins. And in my research, I don't play with test tubes. I don't play with genes. I play with patients. I play with the way care is delivered. So we took a 200-page guideline developed by the Centers for Disease Control that was elegant and scholarly, but completely unusable at the bedside, because who could read 200 pages when you're trying to do care, and culled out from it a 5-item checklist. The items were almost banal in how they are. They were wash your hands, clean your skin with a soap called chlorhexidine, avoid placing these catheters in your groin because they have a higher infection rate, cover yourself and the patient when you're doing this so you maintain a sterile field, and ask every day if the patient still needs the catheter, because you see the risk of infection is having the catheter. Now, checklists are not new. I didn't invent checklists. My 12-year-old son uses a checklist to keep track of his homework that he has to do, and my mom uses checklists when she goes to the grocery store. But for some reason, and I think it's quite frankly because of the arrogance or the myth that doctors are infallible, we haven't used them very often in medicine. We believe that we don't make mistakes, so we don't need something. Now, when we first looked, we found that doctors use these things 30% of the time. Not just at Johns Hopkins, around the country, 30% of the time. So we then said, well, that's not good enough, and we made a cart, because what we found was that when doctors were going around to try to do these things, the equipment that was needed to comply with this checklist was stored in 8 different places, right? The cap was in one place, gowns were in another, masks were in another. No wonder why the doctors didn't use them. So we simplified it and put all the equipment together. That got us up to about 70%. Still not good enough, though our rates came down a little bit. We then said, hey, nurses, we want you to question the physicians. That is, when we're putting these catheters in, if the doctors forget one of these things, unless it's an emergency, go back and make them fix the mistake. And you would have thought I was causing World War III with that, right? Truly unbelievable. The response from the nurses was, it's not my job to police the doctors, and if I do, I'm going to get my head bit off. And quite frankly, they were right. They unfortunately often do get their head bit off. And the doctor said, Peter, there's no way a nurse can question me in public. It makes me look like I don't know something, in which I say, welcome to the human race. We all don't know something. What was striking, though, is nobody debated the evidence, right? They agreed that we should do this. What the barrier was culture. It was power and politics and hierarchy protecting us against shame, but it wasn't the evidence. So I pulled everyone together and said, is it tenable that we harm patients here at Johns Hopkins? And, of course, everyone says no. And I said, and do we all agree that these items on the checklist are sound, that there's strong evidence supporting them, that we ought to use them all the time? And everybody said yes. And I said, then how could you as a nurse see someone not washing their hands and keep silent? We know we're putting the patient at risk if you do that. That can't be. You have to speak up. And doctors, it's okay if you make a mistake. You're allowed to forget. But you're not allowed to put patients needlessly at risk. So if you forget, that's okay, but the nurse will correct you. And you have to go back and fix that mistake. And nurses, if the doctors give you flack, you could page me any time of day or night. You will be supported. I do not want to be paged. And we have to make sure patients always get this evidence. And what that did, that simple approach, changed the dynamic from doing battle, literally, amongst clinicians to putting the patient as the North Star, which they should be, and aligning us towards a common goal. And, you know, people who hear this probably wonder, how could that be in healthcare? Is it really this kind of system where there's antagonism and arrogance? And interesting, I was telling Mike Armstrong earlier, the New York Times reporter Claudia Dreyfus was interviewing me about my book. And she came down, she's a very astute woman, and said to me, "Peter, one of the themes in your book is the arrogance in medicine." And I said, "You're right, it's a very strong theme." And she said, "How many people do you think arrogance kills a year?" Right? And I was taken aback and said, I hadn't really thought of it, but it's likely a lot. A lot meaning thousands. Let me give you an example of what story I tell in the book. Patients who have multiple operations are at risk for developing a latex allergy, that you become allergic to the latex. So I was doing anesthesia on a patient who was having their 10th operation to repair a hernia. So they were set up to have this kind of allergic reaction. And about an hour and a half into the case, the patient showed all the classic signs of an allergic reaction. Their blood pressure went low, dangerously low. They got a rash. They started wheezing like an asthma attack. And to the point I had to give epinephrine, that medicine that jolts your heart to get the blood pressure back up. And so this patient was an extremis. I said to the surgeon, "Hey, I think this patient's having a latex allergy. Go change your gloves to non-latex gloves." The whole hospital is now latex. A few years ago, latex-free, it wasn't. The surgeon looks at me and says, "You're wrong. This can't be a latex allergy. I've operated on this lady 10 times. I've been in here an hour and a half. Can't be a latex allergy." I said, "No, that's the whole point. That's the risk factor for it. This is a latex allergy. Go change your gloves." He said, "No, Peter, you're wrong. This cannot be a latex allergy. Stop bothering me. Let me finish the operation." Right? In the meantime, literally, I'm pushing epinephrine to jolt her heart. I said, "Okay, help me understand the way you see this, because if I'm wrong, I may be wrong. You waste 5 or 10 minutes changing your gloves, going out and coming back. If you're wrong, you kill the patient. Doesn't seem like a very good risk-benefit ratio that we want to do." Right? And perhaps I was wrong for doing that, because he clearly got embarrassed then. And then it became not about what's right, but who's right. "Damn it, Peter, I'm not changing my gloves. Leave me alone." Right? So I'm sitting there having this literally moral dilemma, saying, "Okay, what do I do now? I have this patient who literally is going to die and pushing epinephrine. We're still giving her the exposure to the allergy she's allergic to, and I can't connect with this doctor to get him to go change his gloves." So I say to the scrub nurse in the operating room, "Please go page Dean Miller, the CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine, who's a staunch supporter of these safety efforts. I can guarantee you he will not accept the risk of you not changing your gloves." The nurse turns white and says, "You want me to page who?" Right? I mean, you know, it's a 44,000 employee institution, you know, and so it's a big place. She probably never has seen him, let alone talked to him. I say, and again, I'm pushing epinephrine, "Go page him now." And she walks over to the phone. Surgeon says, "You won't call him." Right? And I said, "Page him now. I will not let this lady die because of your arrogance." To which she starts picking up the phone, dialing. He stands up, says an expletive, throws his gloves down, and walks out of the room. Right? And I reflect on that case, and I said, you know, ignorance is excusable. We all don't know things, and we're all human. The arrogance in medicine, I think, is not. And it's far, far too common. I have yet to do an interview about the book where the reporter doesn't stop the interview and start telling me about their own experiences where either they felt afraid that they had to follow someone in the hospital, or that they were shut down from asking questions and made, you know, to not be very welcome. And I think we need to change this. So we took that program, and the results at Hopkins were breathtaking. We virtually eliminated these infections at Johns Hopkins and then took it to the whole state of Michigan. Now, I have to admit, people thought we were nuts. They said there's no way you can improve care in a whole state. You don't even work in any of the hospitals in the state. That this is too difficult and nobody will play ball, because it really hadn't been done before. And I said, okay, well, let's keep the program really simple. It's the checklist. We're going to get the nurses to speak up, and we're going to measure these infections. And lo and behold, the results were virtually eliminated. I mean, we, within 3 months of starting the program, again, these are something that kills 60,000 people a year. The rates went to zero, and we just recently published that they've stayed zero now 4 years after the intervention. It's truly, we just... we just look at something that will be relevant to you, the Medicare data in Michigan. And regardless of which hospital you went to now after this program, any Medicare patient admitted in Michigan has an 18% lower mortality after this program compared to before, while the mortality trends in the 11 surrounding states are completely flat. I mean, think about that. Nearly a 20% reduction in your risk of dying for something as simple as a checklist, but probably more importantly, creating this culture of collaboration. We are now putting this program in all 50 states, state by state, hospital by hospital. And yet it's frustrating because in many of the states, only 20% of the hospitals are signing up for this, right? And their response is, well, I'm using the checklist, Peter. And I said, yeah, but I and your patients don't care about the checklist. They care about getting infected. What are your infection rates? And the answer is unanimously either I don't know or they're high, but we're using the checklist. And then I say to them, okay, if your rates are still high, let me ask you a question. At your hospital, if a brand new nurse were to see your senior most doctor or senior most surgeon placing a catheter and he didn't comply with the checklist, would that nurse speak up and would the doctor listen? Right? And to give you how an example of how distorted our culture is, the answer is never no. It's laughable. I mean, they literally roll their eyes and say, are you nuts? Of course they wouldn't. And I said, then you don't have the kind of collaborative culture that we need to ensure patients are safe. But it's really, frankly, a sad statement it almost seems unquestionable. So a big part of our program is to build that collaboration and teamwork, or to support those efforts where people do work up and recognize that they're on the same team. You know, I was reading this book called Theory U, which is about, by Otto Schirmer, doing large-scale organizational or societal change. It's a big part of what we're doing. And then he describes this interview where he spoke to one of the Apollo astronauts who was flying over the Earth, really one of the first places to circumnavigate the Earth. And he was flying over the Middle East, and they interviewed him and said, what did you notice when you were flying over that? And he said, what was so striking to me was that there were no lines. The lines are just constructs in our mind. They're something we create artificial. And yet on Earth, we kill people over those lines. Right? And I saw it and I said, what a profound idea, because it's the same thing in medicine or in our politics, that we've seen that our efforts have been far too competitive than cooperative, far too independent than interdependent, and far, far too focused on our efforts than our results. And a big part of what we're doing with this national effort, I equate it with the polio campaign of the 21st century, because polio used to kill about 350,000 people a year in the mid-80s. It's now eliminated from the developed world and virtually eliminated from the developing world, but it only happened because many stakeholders worked together rather than competitively. And in healthcare, we haven't seen that. So I feel like I'm the Wizard of Oz pulling levers, because I'm working with the CDC to get them to focus on this effort, with state health departments to align the measurement with this, with insurers. We finally got the insurers, something unbelievable, to get the insurers, the regional CEOs and chief medical officers of the insurers, to have their incentives tied to the same incentives that the hospital has, that they're going to be incentivized to reduce infections rather than, as you probably know, those two incentives are almost diametrically opposed normally, so that they're going to be accountable for who's participating in getting infection down, and then obviously the doctors and nurses in the individual hospitals all being held accountable for this, because this is just one of the many ills. But we haven't learned how to play together to solve large and substantial healthcare problems that we have. We desperately need health reform, but it has to happen in a collaborative and interdisciplinary way. And part of the beauty of what we do is that it has to be simple. And you know, as the leader of this effort, I have to say it's really scary because unlike most strategic plans where you know where you're going, in this, the future is emerging as we're creating it. I really have no idea. It makes me think of, I don't know if you are, any of you are familiar with that, Picasso painting The Matador. It's one of, in art, it really was a transition to a whole new style of art. But when Picasso painted it, he didn't start with an idea of what he wanted to paint. He painted something, he didn't like it, he painted over it and over it and over it. And that painting was literally redone. The estimates are about 150 to 200 times until what he had emerged. And that's very much the same metaphor that we're doing in this work. We're making a lot of mistakes. We're learning as we go along to bring everybody into the same mixing bowl to work towards a common goal so that when you do go to the hospital, you could either not get infected or be sure that you can look at these infection rates. Now, I said we need to do it simple, and I got this amazing idea for how things work when they're simple from the Netherlands. This is the true story. Netherlands were having problem with men having poor aim in their public restrooms. And it cost them, some of the wives might say it, it's in your house too. And it was costing them a lot of money to clean up. So they did a randomized clinical trial, this is the truth, where they painted a fly on all the urinals. And what they found was that men's accuracy went up 80% when they had something to aim at. And the statistics had a very significant p-value. And I have to confess, when I was over there putting our program in, not only are the flies there, but they really work. I was like genetically encoded to aim at the thing. My wife now paints them in our house. But I heard that story and said, wow, what an amazing simple idea that leads to profound change. So I think now is the time for us to commit to a national program to eliminate these infections. We need a win as health reform, and quite frankly, you deserve it, and we need your support. I think now is the time to ensure that whatever healthcare system you go to, you could know your infection rates and be confident that either they're zero or that they're transparent for you. You have that right to know. And wherever you are in your communities, I hope that you demand that from either at a state level or at the local level. And now is the time for us to make sure that we stop this needless death and suffering. You know, my organization's interest in this began very humbly because we killed a little 18-month-old girl called Josie King. She was born about the same time as my daughter and looked hauntingly similar to her. But she died of one of these catheter infections, a needless death that we didn't catch, and she got dehydrated and essentially died of a third world disease, dehydration, at the world's best hospital. And that death shook us, rightfully so, to the core. And on the four-year anniversary of this little girl's death, the mother is working quite closely with the hospital, came back to me and said, Peter, could you tell me that she's less likely to die today than she was 4 years ago? Could you tell me that care is safer? And the sad reality is, at the time, we couldn't. There wasn't an American health system that could give her an answer. And it's now 10 years after that little girl died, and her mother's still waiting for the answer. And I hope for this one problem, these infections that kill 60,000 people, that together we can give her one. I thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Provenost. And I must say it was an important and absolutely riveting presentation that you gave. And as you said, it's something which is going to affect us all sooner or later. It was refreshing to see someone from the healthcare profession have such an honest approach to the issue. And I think you're really quite unique. During lunch, I learned that Dr. Provenost also had worked in Nigeria, where my husband and I were stationed for some years, and worked in Nigeria in a Baptist missionary hospital. So I do know that his intentions are the very best, and he speaks from deep compassion, which is a wonderful thing to experience in a healthcare professional. So thank you. For you to remember your visit here with us, we have some books for you. And Naples,
thank you.
Of course, the Naples book and the Marco book, which maybe some of you don't know. This book is given to the speakers by Tariq Ayasun, one of our own members. He provides these books for every meeting.
Thank you.
Now we have some questions and answers. Questions. And Mike Armstrong will read the questions.
Peter, you have to realize that this is a very sophisticated audience, and they grade me after the session as to whether I've picked the toughest questions for you to answer. And so I've done my best to sort them according to that criteria. And the first one, given the risks that you have described, what can I, as an individual patient, do to protect myself?
So that's an absolutely great question, and it's funny, because of my concern for the patients, we actually made a patient checklist for when you go to the hospital. So you can email it around, but I'll share it with you now. I think the first thing, if you're going to be at risk of getting one of these catheters, so as I said, you're having a big operation, you're going to be in the ICU, ask what are their bloodstream infection rates. Good hospitals now, their rates are less than 1 per 1,000 catheter days, or they should be 0 for some time. If they're much above that, you're putting yourself at really high risk. Ask, second part, are you participating in this national program to eliminate these infections? Every hospital, it's a federally funded program, because it's not just the checklist, it's the culture change piece that really has that impact on mortality. And again, if no, why not? Third, ask if they're using the checklist, right? When they go to put these catheters in, are you going to make sure that I get what's supposed to? Fourth is, any time a clinician walks into your room or comes to touch you, feel confident to ask, did you wash your hands? And don't, unless you saw them do it, don't assume that they did. I mean, that's one of the biggest ways to prevent these infections. And nationally, people do it around 30 to 40% of the time. It's really, frankly, a travesty, and I think you could quite strongly advocate it. And then if you have a catheter, every day ask, do I still need it? Because the risk of any type of catheter of getting infection is having the catheter in. So they obviously do good if you need them, but staying longer than you do is just a risk. So ask every day that there's a risk-benefit decision to say the benefits are exceeding the risks. Those of you who are active at either a political or at a state level, make sure you have access to in your state to report these infection rates. I mean, I think it's a travesty that something that is preventable and kills this many people, the public are in the dark about. I mean, I think there's a lot of healthcare performance measures that aren't really good measures, and making them public probably does a disservice because the science just isn't there. These are the gold standard. I mean, we know we can measure these well. We know we could prevent them. And I think the public ought to have information about the risks.
Several cards commented on culture and your comments, Peter. And they asked that compensation for doctors is a large part of the culture. And at the Mayo and at the Cleveland Clinic, they're salaried. Is that part of the solution?
Yeah, so that's a good question. At Johns Hopkins, we're salaried also. You know, the U.S. healthcare system, let me give you an example, is you should think of it as an all-you-can-eat buffet. You spend $5.99 and you can get what you want. But what happens at all-you-can-eat buffets? Plates come back overflowing with food. An awful lot goes to the trash and you get overweight. Right? And what we're trying to do is to create the right incentives that people use the health care that they need, but they don't overuse it, and they're incentivized to keep well. And we haven't found the right incentives. We learned some from some of the insurance experiments that when we increase what people pay out of pocket, they reduce their consumption of health care, but they do it for both needed and non-needed services. It's too blunt of an instrument. In Switzerland, for example, one of the things they do is that people create health goals. That I say my weight's going to be X or my blood pressure is going to be under control. And if you meet those goals, you get half of your insurance premium back as an incentive. So that's something I can see. I don't know that salary is going to be the right solution. And I say that perhaps because my political bent or economic bent believes in free markets, and I think they're good. And I think if we were to do that, you would likely have a hard time finding a doctor at night. You may not find doctors on the weekends, and that's what we've seen in other health systems that do this. So I think the market should be there, but we should have transparent performance measures. You know, it's interesting. I just finished reading this book about Southwest Airlines. As you know, they're a remarkable company for both their financial success and their salary. And the woman who, Judy Gattell, wrote about what the magic of it was she said Southwest has done three things. They develop common goals, they develop common knowledge, and they have mutually respecting relationships. Right? And they hire for people who have relational competency, not the top gun pilots. So their pilots are obviously all competent, but they screen them for who's going to get along with the flight attendants and the stewardess. And in medicine, we haven't yet done that, and we need to, because we hire people who I can tell you from day one, you can say, this person will not play well in the sandbox. Their ego's out to here. It's all about me. And I think we have to start putting more emphasis to say, you know, because 40 years ago, when the doctor had a black bag and all the armamentarium was in that black bag, and quite frankly, mostly what it was hand-holding, you didn't need to be a team player, right? Everything I did was in my hands. But now when you're looking at cardiac surgery or cath labs or these radiation therapy that you have, there's no way one doctor knows it all. It requires a team of very competent people who speak up and collaborate. And yet our mindset is still in that 30 years ago of being autonomous and not collaborative. And we need to make that shift. The technology has been racing ahead of us. And now the culture piece has to try to catch up.
The question you've talked about, blood infections. Two, one, how prevalent is MRSA, bacterial infection? And two, what percentage of hospitals really do have an infectious disease department?
Great question. So MRSA is frighteningly common. I mean, it's not routinely measured in most hospitals, so we don't know what the true incident rates of. Of these infections that we're preventing, somewhere between 20 to 40% of them are MRSA. And what's so horrible about that bug is it's very hard to cure. So many people go, as some of you may have even had or your loved ones, go back out into the community with it. There's horrible stories of people having hip and knee replacements or surgeries where their wounds get infected with them, and they need multiple operations to try to clear these infections. And we know, just like these other infections, with some basic principles, we could infect them. You know, the estimates are that it's about 1 in 10 patients who goes to the hospital gets an infection from the hospital. I mean, think about it. That's unbelievable statistic, and we need to. Now, second part of the question is, what percentage of hospitals have an infectious disease department? I suspect most hospitals are. There's no real data on it. You can get an infectious disease consult. The part of the hospital that monitors these infections is either called infection prevention or hospital epidemiology, and they vary widely. So I'll tell you, in some hospitals we're working with, the person who's in charge of infection prevention is a nurse who also is in charge of risk management, might be the head nurse. They're wearing four or five hats, and the amount of time they can dedicate to this is likely very small. At a place like our hospital is large, but we have four full-time physicians and about 15 nurses who are scouring the hospital for monitoring, make sure we're washing our hands, making sure things are done correctly, monitoring and feeding back data on infection rates. So the resources are all across the spectrum in hospitals. The sad thing is it's almost certainly cost-effective because any one of these infections costs somewhere around $30,000. The return on investment in Michigan was 400 to 1. It was a $500,000 investment that the federal government made for that project, and it returned $200 million a year.
Few of us would like investments like that, I think. Peter, I've often heard you speak of how important it is to know the patient. Do you think that the underlying pathology the patient has contributes to many of the infections?
Yes, yeah, so that's a great point. When we started this project, I caught a lot of spears because most of the doctors in the intensive care unit said exactly what you just said, Mike. These infections are what I call in the inevitable bucket. Our patients are sick. They have a lot of comorbid diseases. They may smoke. They have diabetes. We can't prevent these infections. And at the time, I said, you know, you're absolutely right. We don't know if we could prevent them. But we do know that there's these five simple items on the checklist that are known to reduce risk, and we're only doing them 30% of the time. So could we agree to make a health system that every patient will get these five things all the time, and let's see how low the rates go? And you may be right that their patients are sick at our hospital and they're going to get infections and there's nothing we can do about it. But my hunch is that's not so. So we put diligently these five things in the ICUs, and lo and behold, our infections went down. Now, it was interesting. They didn't go down all the way to zero that we had. So we started looking at the infections, and we investigated them as if they were preventable. We changed our mental models to say, no, these aren't the cost of doing business. Let's see. And what did we found? Well, we found half of the infections were from catheters that were placed in the operating room, and we hadn't taken the checklist to the operating room. So we did. Infections came down further. We then found that the few remaining infections that we had didn't have to do with putting the catheter in. They had to do with how we kept the dressing on it. So the infections were in people who were in the ICUs for long periods of times, and the dressings would sometimes fall off, and it was really more of a nursing issue of keeping the catheter on. So we made a checklist for keeping the dressing intact and checking if it was, and that combination went further away. So when I now speak to other academic medical centers who say, as they often do, my patients are too sick, these infections are inevitable, I say, at least for these, not so. You don't treat any sicker patients than we do at Johns Hopkins or the University of Michigan, and both of them have licked these infections.
We had four or five questions from the students, and I think I picked one that would be personal, Peter. What was it during your younger life that influenced you to choose the field of medicine? And for those who might be thinking about that, would you have any counsel?
I'm not sure what made me choose medicine. I always wanted to do it from an early thing. And I remember I was probably about 13, and I was on a camping trip, and we were walking, and there were three mountain peaks that we could have. I was probably about 14. There were three groups of boys, and there were a range of mountain peaks that we could climb. And each of us had a different counselor in the groups. And the first counselor came up, and we're trying to decide. It was the night before. We're sitting by the campfire, which mountain peak we're going to climb. First counselor comes up and says, "You see that hill over there? That's the one we're going to climb," and then gave us an hour lecture how we're going to get there every step of the way, and there was no passion. The second counselor came up I think he may have been high or something. I don't know. He said, hey, guys, you know, there's a lot of mountains there. I don't care what we climb. You guys decide. Do what you want. No passion. The third guy came in, luckily the group I was in, and he said, you see that hill over there? That's the hill we're going to climb, and I'm not sure we're going to make it. It's going to take all of your collective input to help us get there, but boy, does it have an amazing view from the top. I think we're going to get there. Right? And I went home after that experience and talked to my dad about that. And my father said to me, you know, boy, that seems like you had a great lesson in leadership through that. And I said, yeah, I think that really was. And he said, well, what do you think leadership is? How do you define leadership? And that idea tinkered in my brain for a little while. And I said, well, I think leadership is the ability to help people make the world a better place. Right? And leadership is the ability to help make the world a better place. And because to be a leader, I don't need to have all the answers of how we're going to climb the hill. But I do have to make the call about what hill we're going to climb. Right? That's not an option. We're going to get up there. But I can invite collectively everyone in. And part of my reason for doing this in medicine, going into medicine, is I really believe medicine needed leaders. I think there's an enormous leadership void in medicine. And I think people like you have to fill it. People like you who are inclusive and collective and interdependent. And I'm sure you will.
The last question, albeit I'd like to answer one on behalf of Dr. Weiss, are you in the audience still? Please, stand up a minute, because I have six questions here. And the best person to answer them is now standing. And the questions were basically, thanks, Alan. How to go today addressing the Naples Community Hospital? And are they going to adopt your checklist? And I can only say that I was there. And the interest and the response was fantastic. We had to pull them away and almost to get here in order to address the Forum Club. The docs, the nurses, the staff were fascinated, involved, and I think probably the answer is yes, but I don't have the authority to speak for Dr. Weiss, and I'm glad he's still here. The last question. A lot of American medicine is practiced by individual practitioners. Has it become so complex that that form of practice can stay up to date?
Yeah, that's, you know, an amazing question. To give you an example, each year there are 18,000 randomized clinical trials published. Right? If the data is, if I were to try to read all the literature that comes out every year, that I would do nothing else but read, and it's about a 3-to-1 ratio, so I'd have to read 3 years to keep up with it. I mean, the knowledge is just exploding. And I was mentioning last night at dinner, we have a very inefficient knowledge market in medicine. We don't have a good mechanism to try to make sure that that knowledge is always available. As a matter of fact, one of the tools I'm working on is to creating a checklist maker that would allow communities of physicians and patients to put input into saying, hey, what are the 5 most important things that I use to treat diabetes or pulmonary hypertension? And patients could say, hey, these are the things that I see really work, or these are what doctors could say. And that knowledge is broadly available to the public. So you would have this idea of democratizing knowledge. When you go into a doctor, you'd be equipped to say, here's what a community of practice thinks I ought to do. I mean, it's, quite frankly, it's a software issue. I'm not a software technician, so I need to do it. I think primary care medicine and outpatient medicine still could keep up. It's a challenge to keep up. The knowledge is exploding. What I hope we see happening is a humbleness to say, if I'm not sure about what something to do, I get other expert opinion. Because medicine has this strange dichotomy now where the sophistication of the evidence is going up exponentially, and yet we seem to want less and less time with our primary care doctor, seem to be allowing less and less skilled people doing it, and it doesn't seem to make any sense because it's getting more and more technology about what therapies might really benefit from you of all the variety of different disease you have. So I think what we need to do is make sure that we tap into this collective wisdom, and that your primary care doctor or in the hospital is humble enough, if you say, you know, hey, I'm not so comfortable with that, maybe I want to talk to an endocrinologist or whatever, a cardiologist, that that input is welcomed rather than being a threat to somebody's ego.
Thank you, Peter.
Dr. Provenos' book that just came out is for sale in the lobby, and he'd be happy to sign a copy for you. And we'll see each other in a couple of weeks. Thank you.